Now we're going to be moving to a panel discussion. And so I'd like the presenters, if you could, to please join us here on stage. We're also joined by Dr. Evelyn Hurwitz, a pediatrician with Integrity Health Group. Dr. Hurwitz is also vice chair of Optimum Physician Alliance. And rounding out the panel is Don Ingalls, vice president, state and federal relations with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. As our panelists get settled, I'd like to remind you that in your folders there are cards that you can fill out if you have questions for us or for the panel. Questions will be judged both on their content and their legibility, so keep that in mind. And for those of you who are following us on Twitter, you can participate as well and ask a question using the hashtag BNPHCR. That's BNPHCR. And Dottie, we'll start with the first question.
Well, since Dave is late, we're going to give him the first question since he's getting up on here late. You know, I just want to commend all the speakers for, it's dizzying, complex issues that we're dealing with here. And I found it especially fascinating to understand how New York is different than other states. And Dave, I wonder, looking at the differences here, and we saw that New York State businesses, for example, were sort of better represented on the exchange than individuals. What do you think in Western New York is really going to happen? Do you think employers are going to drive more to the exchange, or will they continue to provide health care for their employees?
Well, it's first of all, I don't believe, and I don't, Health Now and Blue Cross Blue Shield in Western New York does not believe that there's going to be just an immediate flood or immediate flip to exchanges, I think, in the employer marketplace. There's a number of reasons for that, and I highlighted earlier today about the ability of businesses to remain competitive and be able to attract and retain those employees. I think that's a key element. That's not going to go away. That has been a hallmark of employer-sponsored benefits from the day it was originally done, and I don't think that objective is going to go away anytime soon. Secondly, I think that there still is a fair amount of concern about the effectiveness around the administration of the exchanges. Can they really handle it? Is the billing and eligibility and the interaction that the individual members may have with those exchanges, is it going to work? We were somewhat fortunate in New York to have a state-based exchange. Certainly not a perfect process, but a much, much better process than what you had heard and probably read about on the federal exchange for a number of states that utilize that federal exchange and the problems related to that. So there's a lot of caution, I think, by employers to simply say, I'm going to wash my hands of benefits. I'm going to decide on a certain amount of money that I'm going to provide, and you as an individual can go to the exchange and deal with it on your own. Certainly there's some of that. I think that it may gain a little bit of momentum, but personally, we don't think that that's going to happen either immediately or within the 2 to 3 year period of time.
Thank you.
Question for Kelly. I was very struck by your figures on where across the state the new enrollees were coming from, and the figure you had for Western New York, 6%, which was significantly lower than other parts of the state. Why is that? Could you explain that and tell us if there's anything that needs to be done to address that?
Sure. Everybody hear me okay? So let me just clarify that the 6% is related to the individual marketplace. The 14% that I talked about in the employer-sponsored, that is still employer-sponsored coverage. So I didn't mean to misrepresent that we're seeing a larger population of employers shifting out of employer-sponsored coverage into not offering their employees benefits. We're actually seeing the opposite, that more employers in the Buffalo area were offering employer-sponsored coverage, but they were doing so through the small business marketplace. So specific to your question, what we're thinking in the western part of the state is, you know, we're obviously increasing our outreach efforts. I think there was a lot of, you know, a lot of focus on the downstate market, making sure that we, you know, targeted the population of people that were, you know, clearly underinsured or uninsured. And now you're starting to see focus from New York State of Health moving into the western part of the state. So I don't have a clear-cut answer for you, other than we think that it probably is, you know, as Dave had mentioned, that there's some, you know, some caution and, you know, people waiting to, and wanting to see whether the exchange is going to continue to, you know, to be operational and actually be something that might work for them.
Mike, I think you're best positioned to answer this question. I think we're all kind of wondering when this is going to settle down and figure out. There seems to be a tremendous amount of uncertainty with healthcare reform. You know, what's your sort of best guess estimate when we're going to see what is going to be the new normal for healthcare?
I mean, I think we're getting to a point now where the only really big thing hanging out there from an employer perspective is that excise tax. I mean, the other stuff that's been out there, it's stuff that's been known. Employers have been thinking through these issues. But 4 years ago, 2018, seemed like a long time away. And now as we're bumping up on 2015, I think there's this reality that we really have to start thinking about this. Employers for a number of years, and you look at the surveys, for a number of years, they were not looking at this at all. You look at some recent surveys, and you're looking at 50% of employers that are very, very concerned now about potentially hitting that excise tax limit. I think you're going to start to see a lot more changes in benefit design. I agree with Dave. I don't think you're going to see folks necessarily rushing to leave. But you are going to start to see a change, I think, in the way those benefits are delivered.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that? Because we got a question from the audience, which I think really relates to this excise tax. So there's been a lot of talk about sort of public sector employees having very rich health care plans here. So the question from the audience member is, how do you foresee the ACA changing health care coverage for public sector employees? And I'm wondering with the excise tax if that has an impact there.
I think the public sector employees are, unfortunately, they're going to have to go to a point where if this thing stays the course, I mean, I think everyone probably in the back of their mind in that public sector hopes that, like everything else, the excise tax gets delayed or that we'll see adjustments. But if not, I mean, employers are going to be facing significant costs that they are not going to be willing to absorb. And so it's moving in a direction, and unless we make change, there's going to be significant costs that employers cannot absorb.
Thank you.
Okay, a question for Dr. Hughes. The ACA is intended not only to bring more people into the healthcare system, but it's also intended to kind of transition us more away from the fee-for-service system toward a system that would focus more on quality and outcomes. How is that going so far?
Difficult process for certain. In a hospital-based system, moving from the fee-for-service, which is the traditional mechanism where services provided are reimbursed, and clearly that's how our financial structure has been based over the past 50 years. In the last several years, obviously, we're moving to the risk-based world where we're taking responsibility for the quality of care we're providing, but also we take responsibility on the cost side. So how do we move in that direction? When you look at hospital-based services, that's about transparency at the physician and provider level. We are measuring ourselves on a daily basis against utilization of supplies, of implantables, of pharmaceuticals. We look at metrics such as length of stay, for instance, in a hospital based on a particular DRG or diagnosis. We are continually measuring ourselves because we understand that ultimately when we go out into the market to sell essentially product, we will be looked at as almost a commodity in that we're going to have large employers saying, where is the best place for me to get healthcare from a value standpoint? Best quality, lower cost. We understand that we will be looked at that way within probably the next 3 to 5 years. That's how healthcare will be purchased. We are positioning ourselves very well to handle that, and we do that across the continuum, ultimately.
Okay, I'd like to follow that up with a question that's based on a conversation I had recently with an emergency room physician here in Buffalo, who said to me that there are all of these new metrics by which his performance is measured, including patient reaction to his service. And he expressed the concern to me that because patients sometimes come to the hospital with pain, which may not be real, because they may want painkillers, that he was getting complaints from patients that he wasn't prescribing these drugs, all because of these new metrics in the ACA. And it raised the question in my mind, is this causing a problem that we have here with prescription drug abuse to possibly get worse? So what I'm just wondering is, are these new metrics that doctors are facing, are there unintended consequences that really could be a problem?
I would say yes. There's clearly some schizophrenia when it comes to some of these, particularly around the patient satisfaction or the HCAHPS scores that are really looked at from the consumer standpoint and now from the payer standpoint as well. In particular, one of the measures is, have you treated my pain? And that question will come up on a survey that's handed out 2 weeks later after a patient has gone home from the hospital. That puts physicians on the front line in a very, very difficult position, right? Because you're asking, you've got one side of the spectrum looking at, well, we've got this large issue with opioid dependence, and how do we get in front of that? How do we prevent that? Yet on the exact opposite side, we have the American Academy of Pain Treatment saying, you've got to treat pain. You can't let people sit in pain. So it's a continual judgment call at the front line for physicians. Very, very difficult. So there is some schizophrenia there. Ultimately, though, I think the intent of patient satisfaction scores and HCAHPS are a good thing. I think we as healthcare providers have not really stepped up to the plate and provided a service to our customers. We have not looked at it that way traditionally. I think refocusing providers and hospital systems on patient satisfaction, I think, ultimately is a good thing. But, yes, there's definitely some schizophrenic pieces of that puzzle.
Yeah, I let's stick with the doctors for a little bit. And Dr. Hurwitz, you're on the hook now. You know, we've heard a lot about these issues from sort of a 30,000-foot view, but I'm interested in your perception on how healthcare reform is really affecting you and the practice of medicine. In particular, we saw Kelly's report that shows that there are quite a few more people who are now have access to health insurance that did not have before, which I imagine is putting additional burden on doctors on the street in terms of capacity issues and all that. I wonder if you could talk to us about what the impact has been to the medical professionals on that.
Certainly. I want to say good morning. I haven't been able to say that yet. Everyone else has. I know people have been talking up here. You've heard a lot about collaboration and partnership between the payers and the hospital system. And I represent the third leg of the stool as providers. And when we talk about the impact on providers, it really points to using our skills most effectively. So up until this point, you know, physicians are trained to be autonomous. We're trained to do everything on our own. And if we can't do it, then we ask the person right next to us to help us do that. And I think that what we need to do is start advanced practitioners, our nurse practitioners, and our PAs that are in our office to help us in teams so that we can deliver care most effectively with high patient satisfaction and give a good quality of care at the same time. So what we're seeing, what the impact on physicians is that it is making us more patient-centered and looking at the care that we're delivering through their eyes. So if you have a team of people in your office that includes a nursing care manager that potentially could greet a person at the door, bring them into the room, make sure that they get all of their care, bring them out and help them make that follow-up appointment, maybe enroll them in a group that will help them with their diabetic care or with their high blood pressure or with children with their asthma or with lactation if they are coming in as a nursing mom and need that group atmosphere. So physicians find that we're being asked and we're trying to kind of work at the top of our license, which is kind of a buzz that you will hear more and more, and using our trained LPNs and our trained RNs and then the mid-level providers, the NPs and the PAs more effectively.
Can I follow up with that just slightly? Doctor, is it true that there is a shortage in Western New York of primary care doctors or an anticipated shortage? And do you think that that they will be able to handle the capacity by doing what you're saying, which is to sort of spread the
contact? So I think that the community has been a little bit nervous and scared about the influx of patients through the Affordable Care Act. And essentially, what we're able to do as physicians is just use our time more effectively and have open access where we might not have had it before. With partnerships through the Buffalo-Niagara Partnership, and you heard Dave Anderson talk about creating and retaining jobs and partnering with the medical school, I think what we need to do is encourage all of the talent that we're training to help us in providing care for the community rather than leaving or potentially specializing. There are incentives now for people to go into primary care. There are primary care tracts. The reimbursements and the move away, actually, for fee-for-service really helps a primary care physician give more complete care. And so with some more financial incentives, more people are interested in going into primary care, and we need to use the enthusiasm that this community has right now with all of the growth in the Buffalo corridor and then the medical corridor to bring people in and to retain them. So I think that we will do fine.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, question for Dave. How are traditional health plans such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield reaching out to millennials, the healthy 26-year-olds, and how important is it that you do that?
Well, I think, one, it's important because we need a balance of demographics across our book of business in order to manage our financials in the way that are sustainable. So we do need a balance. But we access them very differently than we used to. You've seen our traditional marketing campaigns in the market probably for quite a long time, and they had originally been billboards, things where we have community meetings, print advertisement, and so forth, kind of the things that you would know. Today is very different. What we found is that age group doesn't really pay much attention to those things. I don't have my cell phone with me, but I'd hold it up and say, this is how you reach them. That's all that they really know from a market standpoint. So social media and other electronic medium are really the way to do it, and we have begun to access those mediums extensively. And it's remarkable that that group will not necessarily trust a message on a billboard or even in a print advertising in a magazine or a newspaper, but if they see it on their cell phone, they believe it's real. Which is kind of a scary thought, but it is the fact of actually how they access the information. Secondly, once you have them, getting them is one thing. Once you have them, you have to administer their health plan and the information they have on their health plan also in a different way, which is also mobile. They don't want to read a written copy of an explanation of benefits. They don't want to receive premium billings or other claim notices or whatever that information is in a written copy in the mail. They want it pushed to them on a mobile device so that they can access it that way, respond to it that way. And so our marketing campaigns for that specific demographic, is very different than it used to be and utilizes mobile.
Quick follow-up on that. I would imagine that you had in mind a certain target of healthy 26ers that you would have liked to enroll last year. Did you meet that target? How close were you to it? Does it pose a concern at all in the first year of enrollment?
Actually, our experience was that we hit our targets pretty closely. There was a pretty good balance. We were going into the exchange with product offerings. It was a brave new world for health plans. I mean, honestly, no one really knew what was going to happen. Didn't know who was going to enroll. We didn't really yet know at that time how to access them. We had to make some assumptions. And unfortunately, you have to make all those assumptions way in advance because you have to file your product and your rates way in advance without knowing what's going to happen. So that's pretty scary. From a health plan CEO perspective, that's very scary. The reality is those assumptions came pretty close to being true, which was a pretty good balance. And I think you heard from Kelly and others that I think that was a pretty similar experience across the state. I don't think there were really any big surprises in who enrolled. We received a pretty good balance across that block of business. And I think going into this next enrollment period, we're expecting pretty much the same, I think.
I have a question for Don Ingalls. Don is very involved at the partnership, and we appreciate the advice and counsel he gives us. But I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, Don, saying everything that we've heard today about sort of the complexity of where this is going, and we certainly know that New York State is one of the most excessively regulated and taxed places in the country. From an advocacy point of view, what is it that you think that we should be focused on in Albany as it relates to affordable health care? Are there things that we should be looking towards to improve the climate here for people who need health insurance?
I think one of the things that we're looking at is in terms of New York has a number of additional mandates on a very high number of mandates for coverage mandates, which as they get passed and require health insurance to cover a certain service or a certain provider type, add cost to the benefits. And we know that New York has some of the highest mandated benefits in the country, which does add cost to the system. So I think one of the things we need to be careful about going forward is looking at additional mandates and evaluating them. There was a bill passed several years ago that would set up a mandate review commission that would review the efficacy and the cost impact of new mandates as well. And that hasn't been fully operationalized yet, but I think that can certainly help the system going forward.
Don, could you just put a little color on sort of perspective, New York State versus other states, when you talk about sort of richer benefits? What are we really talking about? Do you have any way to describe comparatively?
There's a range of across the country. I think New York leads the way with about 54 different mandates for coverage for various services in health insurance policies. One of the issues with additional mandates is that it also, as the costs go up for a given insured plan, it drives more companies to consider self-insurance and getting out of the insurance market and self-insuring, especially in the larger range of employees. So that's a concern as well.
Thank you.
Okay, another question for Kelly. I'd like to ask you two about the Healthy 26ers and whether statewide you met your targets and how important that issue is for you.
Sure, thank you. So as I had mentioned, 31% of the enrollment fell in the 18 to 34 age band. So yes, I would say that we were pleased with the spread across the age bands. You know, as I had mentioned, New York was trending slightly younger than the national average. And I'll just kind of echo on what Dave had talked about, is that, you know, one of the components for 2015 is a strong outreach campaign for kind of those young invincibles. And I'll also echo that we're finding that, you know, the media component of the young invincibles is really very, very important for this population. They don't respond to kind of the traditional outreach and advertising that we're all used to. You know, they want to see it on their phone. If they see it on their phone, it is to be. The other thing is really working with the health plans to create kind of that value proposition for that population of people. They look at health insurance in a very different mindset. You know, we may be looking at it for financial protection. They're looking at it, you know, if I'm going to pay $60 a month out of my paycheck and not be able to use that money, you know, to support my, you know, after work activities, then they want value for that. So we're seeing, you know, health plans partnering with, you know, with telemedicine companies, because that's what that young invincible population is. They apparently don't mind getting medical advice on their cell phone. We're looking at, you know, leveraging social networking, and we're looking at creating partnerships with companies that support that young invincible population. So things like you know, Map My Fitness or In Motion, you know, things that it puts them in a competitive environment with their peer groups across the state, and in some instances makes you know, healthcare kind of more fun, much more interactive, more group based than those of us, you know, who've been here for quite a bit longer time.
following up and just broadening a little bit here, do you expect 2015 enrollment through the marketplace to be similar to the 2014 enrollment?
So I think moving into 2015 on the individual marketplace side, you know, we're definitely focusing on the full pay. You know, our target for 2015 is about, actually I'm not sure if it's all of 2015 or 2015 and 2016, would be to generate another 350,000 enrollees in the marketplace, and we expect that those will primarily come from, you know, the QHP full pay environment. So yes, I think you'll you know, you'll start to see that there'll be some leveling out of the enrollment, you know, from the state-based subsidized state programs into more of the full pay, you know, pure individual purchasers.
Okay, well, I've been given the hook that we got two more questions here, Jerry. So pick your best question for the, you'll get the last question, but I'll ask the next question. And I'm very fascinated by this concept of consumer-driven healthcare plans, and this the issue of transparency, which, you know, there's a severe lack of in healthcare. And I don't really know if this question is for Dave or for Mike, but what do you think is really, why have we lagged so far behind in New York State with consumer-driven healthcare plans, and what transparency would be needed to create a tipping point to make that more attractive? I mean, Dave, maybe, I don't know if you should take that.
I'll go first, I'll go second.
Okay. You're going to have the better New York perspective than I would.
Well, you know, it's probably a bit of a loaded question.
Sorry.
On why it hasn't taken more. But first of all, there has been a good level of employer-sponsored benefits. I would say a little bit higher level of employer-sponsored benefits in New York State that I've seen in some of the other states that I've worked in. And so the starting point was a little bit different. Secondly, I think that in the nature of the provider reimbursement model, which is a fee-for-service model, almost exclusively in Western New York and in much of the state, then the information that is required to make consumer-driven health plans work well, as Mike had talked about in his remarks, has largely not been there. So it's without that level of information, it is hard to demonstrate at an employer level the real value of those models. And what did happen years ago And I know it happened well before my time in New York a little bit, because it did happen in other communities, is employers and members often jump to consumer-driven model because the upfront premiums were lower. And largely what it did is it created a higher level of cost sharing with that member, that patient, that individual, and put responsibilities on them to be an effective consumer of healthcare. That's the basic concept behind it. And it's an attractive proposal, and also would generally carry a lower upfront premium. But that upfront premium assumes that you're going to make the right decisions at the right time. And you're going to choose the right providers based on their own cost information when you have care. And if that information is not provided, then what happened was a bit of a knee jerk, in that the claims didn't go down because that information wasn't available. And then the premiums and the plans were underfunded because there was an assumption that that was going to work well in the premium, that actually when it didn't work well, then there was a lot of catch-up. So what happened in a lot of marketplaces is that the annual increases in what we call trends in consumer-driven products were actually higher than the more standard products that were in the market, and so they lost favor. And individuals said, why would I go through that process to get an increase, take greater responsibility on myself, but not save any money? And so it switched back, and I think they lost some traction. And it's largely the health plan's responsibility and the provider system's responsibility to provide that level of information to make those plans work. And frankly, we're just kind of getting there now in how we do that. So I think that they will continue in the market. I think there'll probably be additional enrollment in those kinds of plans, and I personally believe that they make a lot of sense, but they have to be administered the right way with the right information at the right time for them to work.
As a follow-up to that, Mike, I'm not going to let you off the hook. Cost is only one factor, right? So it's quality of care and all of that. So in places where there has been success, what level of information is available to a consumer, not just on price, but on quality of the provider?
Quite honestly, even nationally, I don't think there's a great deal of good information available to consumers. And most of the studies that you're going to see that say that costs are driven lower by these plans are driven through studies where there's a choice situation, and what you ultimately have is you have the younger, healthier people that are willing to take the consumer-driven plans, and you have the needier folks with healthcare needs taking the traditional PPO plan. And so when you run the numbers in the studies and you see, oh, wow, this consumer-driven plan is running 20% lower than the PPO, it's not because people are making better decisions. It's simply because those are the people enrolling in the plans. I don't think nationally you're seeing a huge difference in information available than what is available here in New York.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a political question here for Don. As you know, Republicans continue talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act. If the Republicans take the Senate this fall, and if a Republican is elected president in 2016, do you expect that they will attempt to repeal the ACA? And if they do, what happens to all these millions of people who are getting health coverage for the first time?
Well, that's the question for the century, I think. Certainly the platform has been to repeal and replace among the Republican Party members for the last several years. However, a lot of the rhetoric has dropped off in the last year or so as the exchanges have taken place and as the enrollment has increased in the plan, and more people are participating. So it's unclear exactly what would happen. I think there are certain things that it would be very hard to take away. The fact that young adults can stay on their parents' policies till 26. The fact that the law removes pre-existing condition exclusions so that people can't be denied insurance. Those kinds of reforms that are in the law, I think, would be very hard to repeal. So it's not clear yet, but it is interesting to me that the rhetoric has over the last year or so has sort of calmed down.
Do you think it would be harder to take away the expanded Medicaid and to take away the subsidies? Because if you do that in any kind of a repeal and replace, you really are taking people off of health care.
That's right. The subsidies are, as we saw in New York, 74% of the people who enrolled through the exchange in the first year, and this is pretty true nationally, were qualified for subsidies. And then, and the largest share of people in New York were through the Medicaid and Child Health Plus plans. So yes, there would be if it was repealed and taken away, that would cause a great upheaval in terms of the number of people that are insured and receiving that subsidy.
I did get one question from the audience that I didn't get a chance to ask, so we'll do one last question here. Dave, I think this one's for you. It's, in an era of cost control, why has the HealthNow network not done something about self-referral and imaging? If I knew what that question meant, I would ask it differently, but I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, so we're going to get into healthcare costs now.
I don't know.
Because we'll be here until next Friday. But, I mean, the short answer is we've done a lot of different things in both of those areas. Self-referral and imaging is kind of the poster child in a lot of communities for overutilization. And it is one thing to try to go at a procedure like that and say, all right, we're going to deal with that. We're going to put systems in place as a health plan in order to try to reduce overutilization in a particular area of care. The reality is we need an effective partnership with our provider systems to do that. That has to be a joint conclusion. And we've talked at this time, at this symposium, a lot about integrated care. And Scott and others have talked about how we are developing integrated care models that link the provider system, the patient, the health plan together in a more effective way so that the right care is delivered at the right time. And then that creates more affordable right cost care as well. And that's where that effort has to be made, and it is made in our partnerships with Kaleida and other providers in the community. That's where we are getting at those particular areas of care and trying to take overutilization or unnecessary care out of the system together that is not actually ever occurred, which is the best claim to have, one that didn't need to happen and was removed. It's not effective, not as effective, and it is not a winning strategy for us to simply go to the providers and say, lower your cost. We need more affordable premiums. You need to lower your reimbursement rates, and you can go figure out how you're going to do that however you want to do it. That is a historical contracting strategy that does not work today. What we need to do is to work in those partnerships and exchange data, exchange patient information, have concurrent electronic medical records online at the time that they're needed with the providers in a way to begin to so that unnecessary care just doesn't need to happen. And in that way, we'll get at that more affordability aspects of those various functions.
Thanks.
And maybe, I don't know if David or Evelyn want to argue with me about that.
I would just add that from a provider and a system standpoint, it's that electronic connectivity and concurrent review with best practices is where we're going on the provider level. We need evidence-based medicine to drive our practice ultimately, and I think when we bring that level of data to the provider, when I talk about transparency, bringing that level of data and that level of transparency at the provider level, who's making decisions, and then even one step further down to the patient level, I think ultimately that will drive not only the cost, but quality will improve as well at the same time. So
is that an opportunity for Western New York with HealthyNet, which I know is sort of a fairly unique program around the country? Do we have a leg up to get to that place, Dave, that you're talking about, in terms of leading the nation in that way?
Well, I would say that process, I would not say it's necessarily a leg up on others. I think there's a lot of those efforts around the country being done, but it's a step in the right direction. And what we need to do is that system is largely historically based. So it's good information. It's good to carry electronic medical records or data, and that ultimately can affect the continuum of care that you're in. But it is not yet brought right to the physician's office or to the point of service where it can be accessed, and that's our next challenge.
Right. And can I just put in a little addition? And I agree. HealthyNet is a link is one way to look at it, and then you heard mention of the Optimum Physician Alliance a little earlier, and that is the group that I represent as well, and that is the group of physicians, primary care physicians, and specialty care physicians that are working to bring that partnership together to our patient population to increase the quality outcomes. And as a physician, it's really important to feel that you are part of the puzzle and even maybe driving the decision-making for what we provide for our patients. And so having the Optimum Physician Alliance and bringing the physicians to the table, partnering with the payer and the healthcare system, has really empowered a lot of the physicians that really want to be there and be at the forefront and make some of those decisions as far as what is quality and how is the best way of delivering care to our patients, because that's what we do. And so I think that's going to be key in making sure that we attain the goals of cost containment and efficiency, as well as increasing and maintaining and increasing quality of care.
That sounds like a perfect way to wrap up this session, those words of wisdom. And I want to thank all of you for being here, and my co-moderator, Jerry Zaremski, for coming from Washington to be with us today and asking such insightful questions. And I'd like to thank the staff members of the Buffalo Niagara Partnership and Blue Cross Blue Shield for all the work they did to make today happen. And Dave, I want to thank you for your leadership that you provide to us every day. So thank you all. Have a wonderful day, and we're pleased you're here.